One of the many perversions of our sin nature is our perverted sense of time. We have our own timetable that sort of dictates our expectations of when God should act and, you know, what sort of timetable we put our requests in, and we expect to see things and God accomplish X and Y according to our timetable. Our faith can limp along for a little while, but then it sort of runs out of steam and we sort of lose heart. And that internal alarm clock goes off inside of us, and it says the time's up. You know, so somehow things are over. God hasn't acted. The delay on God's part, we look at God's delay, and we wrongly interpret it to be a denial of whatever our quest for deliverance is. So that tick, 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 you know, in chess when you're moving, in fact, I have to purchase a new time clock. My old one from the high school days has worn out. The nice present that you gave me a while back, if you remember the nice gift card that you gave me, I used it to get online and do some chess things online, but I also am using it to buy myself a new chess clock. And it's that, you know, just that sense of that clock that we have internally that just goes off, and we say our flag has dropped. You know, the flag's dropped, and we've lost. You know, we're done for. We're going to see in Mark chapter 5, we're going to see two different accounts, two different miracles that are interwoven. One is sort of inserted in the middle of the other one. We're going to see God working in a way that, from the human perspective, it just seems like, hey, things have taken too long. It's a hopeless, both situations are hopeless situations from the human perspective. But we're gonna learn that it's, you know, it's never too late to trust in Jesus for deliverance. It's never too late. We don't want to check off in our time clock, oh, it's too late to trust in God. It's never too late to trust in Jesus for deliverance. And we don't want to misinterpret God's delays to be God's denial. So we're going to look at three stages of faith that I think are reflected in the situations, these two miracles that are intertwined here. First, let's read together verses 21 to 24. Remember, Jesus has been sort of driven off from the country of the Gerasenes, where the swine had been infected with the demons, and the herdsmen and the townspeople had said to Jesus, hey, get out of here, basically. And so it says in verse 21, when Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. One of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up, and on seeing him, fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live. And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and was pressing in on him. First stage of faith I'd like us to look at is the stage of hope, the type of hope that leads to the initiation of faith, to getting started on the journey, on the pathway of faith. Here you have a man who's in a desperate situation, who comes to Jesus with this desperate plea for help. So you have Jairus and his situation with his young 12-year-old daughter that we learn is his only child. And we see the need that he has. Now, the disciples, as Jesus here is going to recross the other side, they might have thought twice about getting into the boat again, the same boat that they'd had the harrowing journey before, where they were so glad to get to the other side. Now, they didn't stay there very long. They had the interaction with the demon-possessed man, and now all of a sudden they got to get back in the same boat and cross back over. But it's an uneventful journey this time, and what we see is the great contrast between the hearts of the people on one side of the Sea of Galilee that wanted Jesus to get away and to depart versus the hearts on the other side that were so curious and expectant and longing to see Jesus work miracles, and they'd heard so much about his power that they're ready for him. When they hear the news that he's coming there to back and crossing back over, they're just thronging around and pressing about him to such a point that he feels he has to sort of stay by the seashore. He can't even go inland. He doesn't even try to progress inland because of the great throngs and the crowds that are there pressing upon him. So there's quite a difference in reaction in terms of these two groups of people. But I'd like us to think, first of all, of the privilege that we have of access to Jesus. Accessibility to Jesus is a privilege that we take for granted so much. How easy it is for us to come to the Lord with our problems and our requests. No matter how desperate we are, we have that access to the Father through the Lord Jesus Christ, and we come directly to Christ as our advocate, as our great high priest, as our intercessor, as the mediator between man and God, as the perfect man and yet one who is perfect God. We have that relationship with Jesus, and we have that privilege of access. Think of the people here who long to have access to Jesus, the difficulty that they had gaining access to Jesus. You know, we think what a privilege it must have been to be there physically at the time of Jesus. Well, think of the privilege it is for us. We don't have to worry about going and leaving our city and trying to make a long journey someplace to get physically into the same association and vicinity where Jesus is. We have that access all the time, and we take it for granted. But here, you have people that that are so excited to be able to press up against Jesus and to have him there in their midst and to bring their requests and especially their need for healing to Jesus. Now, faith seeks to engage the power of Jesus while there is still hope. This passage at the beginning here is all about the hope that this synagogue official has. It's just sort of a glimmer of hope. This hope is almost out. It's almost extinguished. I mean, he's in such a desperate situation. You can imagine how he must have hurried to go to see Jesus. He's a very prominent figure. He's identified as one of the rulers, one of the officials in the synagogue. So he's not a paid clergyman as the scribes and the Pharisees were, but he's in that sort of plurality rulership in the synagogue where they had these prominent elders, probably wealthy men. So he's probably a prominent man and a man of some substance and certainly influence in the community, a well-known individual. But here his money couldn't buy what he really needed. What he really wanted was the health of his poor young daughter. That, you know, when it comes to health situations, sickness, disease, death, they're all that great leveler that puts us all on the same plane. It doesn't matter what socioeconomic status, what our background is, what our racial status is, what our back, it doesn't matter. We're all on the same plane of looking to one who is greater and has dominion and sovereignty over disease and over death. That's what we're going to see in this passage. That Jesus, just as he had authority over the demons, now he's going to show that he has authority and dominion over disease and even over death itself in these miracles that he performs here. So you have one of the synagogue officials named Jairus. He comes up and it took a lot of effort. It wasn't just an easy thing for him to come up. It says it so simply in the passage. But we don't know all that he went through to take this journey upon himself, to push his way through the crowd and the throng, to get to the point where he could even address Jesus. It took a lot of faith on his part. It took a lot of hope to initiate things, to get into the situation where he could have this interaction with Jesus. And so we see that he comes up here, and upon seeing Jesus, he falls at his feet, and he has this humble approach, this worshipful approach, this respectful approach to Jesus. He has this recognition, to some extent, of who Jesus is and his power and his authority, and that he's the only one that can provide the help that his poor 12-year-old daughter needs. And so he entreats him earnestly here. This word implored earnestly, it's interesting. It's a word that's sprinkled throughout chapter 5 here. It's used by different individuals. In chapter 5, verse 10, you see that the demon-possessed man, it says, he began to implore him earnestly, the demons did. When he was calling when he identified the demons as legion, you see that the demon here began to implore Jesus earnestly not to send them out of the country. That same earnest imploring word is used there. It's used of the townspeople in verse 17. The townspeople were imploring Jesus to leave their region. And then in verse 18, the one who'd been rescued, who'd been healed, who had been demon-possessed there, he was imploring Jesus that they might accompany him. There's a lot of beseeching and earnest entreaty and very desperate begging that's going on in this passage on behalf of a lot of people, that Jesus is entertaining all of these very desperate pleas all of the time. And so we see this man, Jairus, he's at the point where his hope is almost extinguished, but he's in his faith, as limited as his faith is, and his faith isn't perfect, because you notice that he says, Jesus, he wants Jesus to come and lay hands on her. He doesn't have the faith of the Roman centurion that says, I know you don't even need to come. I know you can just say the word and you can perform the healing. So his faith isn't even at the level of that Roman centurion, but as weak and as imperfect as his faith was, Jesus responds to his faith. And it says in verse 24 that Jesus goes ahead and says, and he went off with him, and a great multitude was following him and pressing in on him. So you see that this journey of faith, now the initiation has taken place, and now Jairus is on this journey of faith with Jesus. This faith isn't just something that happens in an instantaneous frame of time and it's over and you see success or failure just right at that moment. It's something that has some duration to it, and this man is now on this journey of faith. He's engaged Jesus. Jesus has agreed. Among all the pressing problems and issues, if you can imagine, this whole throng, Jesus has singled out and focused his attention on this one individual, and in a gracious and compassionate sense, he's now committing himself to meet the needs of this one individual, and so he's going with him. What hope that must have stirred in the heart of Jairus, as he, you know, it's probably better than he had even anticipated. He thought, what a long shot. I am one person in these thousands that have needs that are going to come and press upon Jesus. What a long shot, but I'm going to take that. That's the only shot I have. And so he takes it, and you can imagine his excitement and his anticipation and his joy and his sense of urgency as he's trying to hurry Jesus along. He's trying to say, let's pick up the pace. You know, but the crowd is pressing upon him so much that it's difficult for them. They don't have any secret service there to sort of part the waters and to advance scout and make the way easy for them. They're having to press through this crowd, it says, that's pressing among them. And you can imagine Jairus, his heart thumping within himself as he wonders, are we going to be too late? Are we going to get there in time? And he's trying to hustle things along and have things go as quickly as they can. And so our pathway, our journey of faith, we're going to see there can be many minefields along the way. There can be many twists and turns. It's not necessarily a linear progression where everything just builds in sort of stair-step fashion, and we continue to see our faith go from A to B to C and everything gets better and better. No, there are rabbit trails and pitfalls and minefields in this journey of faith we're going to see. On the part of Jairus, as we look at things from his perspective, it's going to be a difficult type of a journey. And yet the important thing that we see at the beginning here is his hope. That his hope was in Jesus, and his hope helped him to initiate his faith and get started on the journey and understand that you can turn to Jesus before it's too late. It's not too late to go ahead and trust Jesus for deliverance. And so he goes ahead and he gets started on this journey. But now as we get to the next paragraph, the story's going to ramp up a little bit. I mean, it's already intense, but now the drama, the intensity, it's going to build, it's going to sort of multiply, because now, in addition with dealing with the challenge of Jairus, we're going to add into the equation the complexity of the faith of another woman who comes along and who intersects Jesus and interrupts him upon this journey, because she's seeking deliverance for a 12-year-old bleeding plague. And so we're going to read verses 25 to 34. This is the miracle within the miracle that we see Jesus performing. Verses 25 to 34. A woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years. Interesting, 12 years is the same number of years as that small child that Jesus is going to say. There's a parallelism there, you know. So she's got a 12-year-old issue herself. She had endured much at the hands of many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse. After hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak, for she thought, if I just touch his garments, I will get well. Immediately, the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. Immediately, Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. But the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." See the tenderness. We see the compassion of Jesus here. We see the faith. Again, the focus is in on the faith of this woman, as imperfect as it is. I mean, her faith thought that there was something magical about Jesus' garments. That just the tassel, if I could just touch the garment, you know, that there's almost this, you know, there's just some superstitious element there, some magical element there. And her faith, though, is something that Jesus regarded. But we're going to see the second stage of faith. And the first stage of faith sort of got us going. It got us started in terms of hope leading to the initiation of faith. Now we're going to see the conviction on the part of this woman who has this plague of this bleeding issue. She has this conviction that leads her to the activity of faith. She takes action. She goes at great difficulty. You can imagine how weak this individual must have been. If you're in a situation where you've been experiencing that type of physical affliction, she couldn't have been in a very, very strong individual. She had to be someone who was rather anemic and rather just challenged in many ways physically, compared to all of the fully healthy people that are thronging about Jesus, trying to get his attention, trying to reach out to him. And yet here she knows enough about who Jesus is and believes in how powerful he is that she wants to get close enough to be able to reach out and to touch him. She had this conviction regarding the power of Jesus that energized her faith and caused this conviction that drove her to take action and to have her expend the energy that was necessary to come in contact with Jesus. And we look first of all at her problem. She had a persistent problem. She had, it says, a hemorrhage for 12 years. So it's some type of a female bleeding issue, apparently, that she had. And she had this hemorrhage of blood that would have made her unclean, ceremonially unclean from a religious and from a society standpoint. She would have been a cast-off. She would have been one who wasn't supposed to be out there. Certainly she wasn't supposed to be touching Jesus. That's one reason, I think, why she just touches his little tassel on his cloak. Doesn't even touch his body physically. You know, she's in this unclean status where she's going to be challenged as to, why are you even out among everybody here? And why are you coming into contact with Jesus? She could be very much challenged and attacked on that type of basis. But she had dealt with this problem over a 12-year period. You can imagine the pain and the agony and the trouble that she had suffered. She had certainly suffered physically. It says in terms of how discouraging her distress was, it was discouraging from a medical standpoint in terms of the medical failure. She had endured much at the hands of many physicians. She had tried to avail herself of what was possible to be gained from the different advice and the different medical help at the time that was available. You know, they had their challenges, I guess with healthcare costs too, you know, and mm-hmm. with the doctors not always having the right diagnosis and the right remedy to prescribe. Here she had gone from one physician to another, and she had, it said she'd exhausted her, this financial drain. Part of her distress was she's out of money. She's bankrupt. Now, she's got, the doctors aren't even going to help her anymore. They're going to turn her away and say, well, where's the pay? You know, no pay, no remedy. You know, well, I've paid a lot, and instead of getting any help, I'm worse off than I was before. Those of us who have had a lot of, you know, we've had medical issues recently, you know, and we think, well, where's our money going? What has our money really gotten us in terms of all we have invested? And we go and we get diagnosis after diagnosis and try this treatment. And we see the limitation on the part of these medical doctors. And it's not like they have the answer to everything. And so she's in a very discouraging situation from the medical standpoint. She has nowhere else that she can turn to for help. From a financial standpoint, she's been drained. From a societal, religious, relationship standpoint, she's unclean. She's sort of a stigma, an outcast, almost like a leper type of situation that she's in. And yet she's dealing with a physical difficulty, a deteriorating condition. It says it keeps getting worse and getting worse, and so she's in a situation where she has extremely been suffering. And so she comes, and it's interesting, in verse 27, she takes this aggressive approach because of the conviction of her faith. She comes, and it's an aggressive approach, but it's a very guarded approach. It's very interesting that she doesn't come and try to get a face-to-face encounter with Jesus. We have to ask ourselves, why does she come up in the crowd behind Jesus? She makes all of this effort to come to Jesus. You would think that she would want that compassion, the eyes of Jesus, to look into her eyes and to see her grief and to see her hurt and be able to connect with her emotionally and personally. You would think that she would want that type of interaction after she has come so far. But now for some reason, she's guarded in her approach to Jesus, and she wants to get a silent salvation. She wants to get a hidden deliverance where she can sort of surreptitiously sneak up behind him, touch his tassels of his cloak there, be healed, and then scurry off into the crowd, not seen by anybody, not recognized, with no interaction with Jesus. For she thought, if I just touch his garments, I shall get well. So she had this faith-based mindset. She had, in the midst of some of her superstitious elements and some of her lack of faith, she had this faith that it was a conviction-based faith that Jesus could do this for her. But I had to ask, I mean, the question in this particular encounter that really interested me was, why was this woman so reluctant to have a face-to-face encounter? What drove the embarrassment? What drove the fear? What drove, whether it was shame or what was involved? And the one of the expressions that really struck me is down in verse 33, where after Jesus recognizes her and they have the interaction, it says that she told him the whole truth. She told him the whole truth. And I wondered, boy, that's an interesting expression, the whole truth. That sounds to me a lot more than that she just recited to him, oh, I'm the one. You know, you've identified, you found out who it was that really touched you, and now the whole truth is that it's me. I think that there's a word that's used here, back up in verse 29, where it says, immediately the flow of her blood was dried up. She felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. That word affliction, it's a word scourge or whip. It's used in a lot of contexts of some type of chastisement, like even divine chastisement. And I'm thinking that there's a connection here behind the scenes, and this is just conjecture. It's not spelled out in the text here. I'm thinking that this 12-year disease that she has, this blight that has been upon her physically, I think there's some connection between some type of divine discipline. Maybe there was even sexual sin involved on her part. And now there's been this issue of blood, and I think that there's shame involved. I think there's a spiritual element in terms of moral behavior that's involved in this. This word affliction is what drives me to that, and this concept of to why she comes from the rear and doesn't want to see Jesus personally, and this fact of telling him the whole truth. I think that she had a confessional experience there with Jesus where she related to him, I understand that my affliction came about because of such and such sin, and this is God's hand of discipline upon me that I've repented. And I think now she's receiving by faith. She's receiving the complete forgiveness of sins. The healing in this case is always, these healings are always symbolic of the spiritual healing that takes place. There's always, Jesus is making the connection when he says, you know, that your faith has made you well, go in peace, be healed of your affliction. It's much more than the physical ailment that Jesus is dealing with. He is dealing with the spiritual side of things and the ultimate deliverance and salvation that Jesus is bringing as well. So I can't be dogmatic as to whether there's any connection. There doesn't have to be connection between sickness. There isn't always connection between some kind of affliction and some type of sin issue. But I think on the part of this woman, as I look at how she interacts with Jesus and how she came then when he identified her, he wanted to have this. Jesus is the one that wanted to have this personal interaction. He wanted to be able to communicate to her the full forgiveness of sins, the full spiritual healing. And I think that there was a spiritual element, a sin element that was involved here in terms of this affliction and this healing. So we see that the woman, she could feel herself healed immediately physically, and Jesus could feel the power going out. The power went out in a volitional sense. I mean, it was Jesus, was willing to go ahead and respond to her faith, was willing to go ahead and heal her. And he knew who it was that had touched him. That's why he looks around in the crowd in order that he might see her, that he might connect with her. And then that's what drew her in to then come and to fall at his feet and to tell him the whole truth. So then this spiritual healing that goes beyond the physical healing is attributed to her faith, as Jesus says to her in very tender and very compassionate terms. Jesus says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well in a complete sense, in a wholesome sense. Go in peace. Go in forgiveness of sins. Go in a sense of restored relationship with God, something that goes beyond just the physical ailment that you had. And also, what's included in it is the physical healing of your affliction." But again, that affliction has that sense of this scourging and this whipping and this chastisement, and I think the disciplinary aspect that goes along with that. So that might be a little bit different than maybe what you've understood that passage, but I would just ask you to entertain the possibility of that. But the application, it's not enough to just get started in your faith. You need to have the aggressiveness of a conviction. Your faith has to have a conviction that motivates you to step out and to take action. Just as this woman, her faith motivated her to be aggressive, and even in her guarded situation where she was also kind of careful and cautious, her faith and the conviction of it led to the activity of trusting Jesus to exercise his power on her behalf for deliverance. So you can imagine that we've for a time now, we've put Jairus sort of over here on the sidelines. I mean, he's been standing over here, and he's the one that had come to Jesus first. Imagine his thinking, wait a minute, he says, "I was first in line. How did I get a back seat all of a sudden? Why this delay? Why this interruption?" It must have been agonizing to him to have Jesus take time to go through this interaction with this other woman when we're already falling behind. The situation is already so urgent. And so now we're taking things back up from the perspective of the father, of the official of the synagogue here, and trying to look through the lens of his eyes and see how he viewed this whole incident and this interruption. Again, it looks like a delay on the part of Jesus. And in fact, this delay is going to seem just deadly to him, because we see in verse 35, it says, "While he was still speaking," okay, while Jesus was still speaking to the woman, "some of the people from the house of the synagogue of the official," whether it's friends or neighbors or even family members, it says, "they came from the house of the synagogue official," saying the message that they bring to him. And you can imagine how difficult it was for them to deliver this message to this important, influential figure that I'm sure they loved. But here they come to bring the truth, the reality, the harshness of the situation. They say, the reality is, your daughter has died. But you can't soften the blow of those words. There's nothing that you can do that would lessen the impact on the heart of this dear father who had this precious only daughter. "Your daughter has died. Daddy's little girl is dead. Why trouble the teacher anymore? Why should you go to the effort? Why should we bring Jesus all the way over to the house? Why should we bring him into the room just to have him observe the fact that, oh, things are too late here?" But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, Jesus said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe." Jesus presents things in such simple terms, you know. It's easy to say, don't be afraid anymore. Just keep on believing. And Jesus allowed no one to accompany him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the synagogue official, and Jesus saw a commotion, and people loudly weeping and wailing. And entering in, Jesus said to them, "Why make a commotion and weep? The child has not died, but is asleep." These same mourners now, they began laughing at him, at Jesus. But putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions. You remember Peter, James, and John. Took his own companions, and he entered the room where the child was. Taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha, kum," which translated means, "little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately, the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years old. She didn't have any problem walking. And immediately, they were completely astounded. And he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this, and he said that something should be given her to eat. There's a lot of immediately's in this passage. That's how Mark writes. That's his style. It's just immediately this, and then immediately this, and then this, and then this. And he just goes one event after another. But here we see the third stage of faith. It's not enough to get started in your faith. It's not enough to aggressively take action in terms of the conviction of your faith. You must persevere in your faith. You must have the assurance from God that stirs your heart to persevere and to keep on believing that this journey of faith is not a one moment in time type of an episode, but this journey of faith is an ongoing, keep on believing type of faith that must be exercised. So there's an enduring aspect, a persevering aspect to this faith in terms of these stages of faith. God's delays, they present a threat to persevering faith. Certainly Jairus had a tremendous temptation to be bitter. And I'm sure thoughts of bitterness crossed his mind. I'm sure he entertained thoughts of, why, Jesus, why did you have to stop and delay? We were on track. We were heading down the road towards my house. Why did we take this detour? And why did we sort of get off track? Excuse me. So he must have entertained thoughts of bitterness, of, you know, this doesn't seem fair to me that Jesus would act in this way. And yet Jesus was trying to demonstrate that all along, I still have your best interests in mind. I have, and despite that I'm ministering to this other individual, I haven't lost sight of you. I didn't forget about you. I'm not unconcerned. I didn't lack compassion for you. I'm doing both. I'm delivering this woman, and I'm dealing with your situation as well. So the word of discouragement comes from the world as these messengers come and they deliver this message. It's too late. That alarm clock, you know, that chess clock, the flag is dropped. You might as well roll up your board and your pieces and go home. You lost. You know, the game's over. You can't make another move. You can't have a different strategy. You can't take a different tact. Once that flag drops, the tournament director says, no, there's nothing to discuss. Don't come to me for an adjudication or for some. It's over. You lost. Your time is up. And you're done. Go home. And so these people come with that word of discouragement. To them, it's a word of reality. It's not, I mean, we don't fault them for bringing this message. That's the situation is that the girl has died. But the interpretation that therefore it's too late now to trust the Lord, that interpretation is wrong. It's never too late to trust the Lord for deliverance. Jesus wants to bring the message that what you need to do in your faith is you need to persevere. You need to keep on trusting me. No matter what the circumstances are, you need to keep on trusting me and not fear. Why should you have fear and be paralyzed in your fear? So the Savior brings this word of encouragement that is very simple. Do not be afraid any longer, only believe. And again, it's a present tense Greek imperative that says, keep on doing this, keep on believing, don't give up in it. You have to have this perseverance in faith, and it's a word of assurance from Jesus. You know, the scriptures, a lot of times it presents things in this cycle where you have sort of the birth of a dream and you have the death of a dream, and then you see the resurrection aspect and Jesus bringing things back to life and Jesus bringing things to that hope and that fruition and that joy that even goes beyond what your hopes and your expectations were in the beginning. And you see that cycle in our own lives at times where Jesus initiates something in your life and you sort of think that, well, maybe I can trust Jesus for this, but then it seems like, well, it just doesn't seem like it's going to happen, or we give up, or it's a, and yet Jesus can eventually bring it about. And there's this need to persevere in faith. And one of the commentators, Deffenbaugh, I thought he had an interesting title to his sermon. He says, when there's death, there's hope. That, you know, we think when there's life, when there's, oh, there's life, there's hope. And he turns that around and says, you don't even need life, you know. When there's death, there's hope. When there's Jesus, there's hope. You know, it's never too late. Don't give up in trusting in Jesus. And so God's perspective that he gives here provides assurance to this persevering faith. And so it's a training opportunity. That's why Jesus just takes his inner circle of his committed disciples, of Peter, who's Peter's the eyewitness. That's whose account Mark is giving. He got it from Peter. He got these words, that's why these precious words that are not even translated, this Talitha Kum, you know, that's left untranslated, those are the words that stuck. They were seared in Peter's mind. He was there when Jesus spoke those words. He communicated those words to Mark. He says, let me tell you what happened. He says, it's just remarkable. I was there with James and John, and Jesus spoke these simple words, Talitha Kum. And this little precious 12-year-old girl who was dead, she got up off of her bed and she started walking. What an amazing thing. Those words were so precious to Peter. And they're communicated in this eyewitness account as Peter gives those words here to Mark to record. And so it's a training opportunity for Jesus' devoted disciples to grow in their faith, to prepare them for leadership roles in the Great Commission ministry that they're going to have. But the perspective of the world is one of weeping and wailing and just giving up. It's interesting. These are professional mourners that were brought into this situation. That was sort of the tradition and the culture, especially if you had money like Jairus had. Even if you didn't have money, you were supposed to hire at least the Mishnah stipulated that even the poorest husband in Israel should hire not less than 2 flutes and 1 wailing woman when his wife died. You know, that's what, you know, at least to have that much noise and commotion and hubbub. I mean, they didn't mourn in silence. They didn't go off in a corner and have a pity party. They mourned and grieved in a very much of a venting type of a fashion where it was very loud, bewailing. They still, in the Mideast, it's still, if you see, on TV and you see the scenes, and it's very different than our funeral and our grief types of experiences. It's very loud and vocal. And so there is a lot of commotion here. And these same individuals, you know, they're just there. It's a job for them. They're hired. What a terrible job to have. You know, what's your job? I go to dead people's homes and I weep and wail and make a commotion. Wow. That's a terrible job. You know, they think of our funeral directors. They don't have a very good job, but it's not as bad as that, you know. So the perspective of the Savior, you know, is he just, you know, they're laughing at him and they're mocking the faith. And yet God's going to demonstrate, Jesus is going to demonstrate his resurrection power and authority. He has dominion, not just over demons, but now he has dominion over disease and even dominion over death. Amen. And so he focuses, in order to have the focus of faith, he shuts out all of these other interruptions and distractions and people that would not be believing and would be mocking the faith. And he shuts all of these out in order to simple focus in faith and exercise his resurrection power. And by just the command of his word and then just taking her by the hand in a very tender gesture, he commands her to rise up. And immediately she walks in. Of course, we have this tremendous response of amazement. It says, really, the literal translation would be, they were amazed with a great amazement. It uses the word twice in a noun and in a verb and combines them together. So we translate it a little bit differently in English. But they were amazed with a great amazement. I mean, what a thing to experience the resurrection power of Jesus, way beyond what Jairus could have thought or imagined when he received that sad word that his daughter had died and that it was too late and he shouldn't trouble the master any longer. And yet, Jesus pressed forward, and he's the one that told the official, look, we're going to the house, we're going to get this done. He's the one that interpreted that death to be just a sleeping type of phenomena. Jesus painted the death of a believer. You know, that's important for us to just look at that analogy there to see when our loved ones die, from Jesus' perspective, it's just a temporary type of a condition. There is going to be a bodily resurrection for all that have fallen asleep in Jesus. Now, so really that's why for believers it's viewed as a tranquil, as a peaceful type of condition. It's not one that there should be the agitation and the commotion and the bewailing and the, we shouldn't mourn as unbelievers mourn, because we should view it as this sleep type of condition that's temporary and that's going to be relieved with the ultimate reunion of a resurrection body with the soul, so that the soul doesn't even exist naked forever, but it's actually combined with a resurrection body, and there's going to be this completeness to the resurrection experience. Now here, this is someone where this little girl is going to die again later on in her years, but Jesus is just demonstrating his resurrection power. But then after this amazement and everything, you can they're just so taken up, they can't even think in a practical sense. So Jesus just closes with a couple of practical instructions. First instruction is very strange. I mean, this, for Jesus to give this instruction, what is Jesus possibly saying? He says he gave them strict orders, not just commands. He gave them strict commands that no one should know about this. What? Do you know what's just happened? Your daughter has been dead, and now she's been raised up, and you're not to go tell anybody. No one should even know. Well, obviously, some people are going to know, and some people are going to find out, but Jesus does not, in this instance, as we've seen before, Jesus doesn't want there to be all this hubbub where there's an evangelistic campaign oriented around him as the resurrection person who raises people from death. He does not want to get ahead of himself in terms of his journey to the cross and his appointed time to go and die for the sins of mankind. He doesn't want to get ahead of himself in that whole process. And so he has to tone things down and give this word of caution and say, look, we don't want to stir up the opposition more than it's going to be stirred up. And so we're going to try and mitigate that aspect in a very surprising type of instruction that Jesus gives there. But then the second instruction is one that's very practical. He says there should be care given for the physical needs. Don't forget, that she's been raised from the dead, but that doesn't mean that she's got some supernatural power and now you treat her like she's some goddess. She's just raised back to be your 12-year-old daughter. She needs you need to take care of her. She's hungry. Can you imagine? She's gone through a little bit of an ordeal here. Let's feed her. Let's take care of her. Let's, in a practical way, go and reintegrate her into the whole natural functioning of your family group and of society. Let's reintegrate her into physical life, and let's go ahead and provide for her in a compassionate way. And all of this happened, in a very instantaneous type of miraculous type of fashion. Here's a quote from commentator James Richards as he looks at these two incidents and says, what's going on here with Jesus taking one miracle and then sort of sandwiching in another miracle in the middle of it? And he says, what does Mark accomplish by sandwiching the woman's story into the story of Jairus? Jairus and the woman have only one thing in common. Both are victims of desperate circumstances who have no hope apart from Jesus. Otherwise, their stories diverge sharply. Jairus has a name and a position. As ruler of the synagogue, he has enough clout to summon Jesus to his house. The woman has none of these. Her name isn't even given. It's not even remembered. She has no position. Her only identification is her shame, a menstrual hemorrhage. She must approach Jesus from behind, whereas Jairus approaches Jesus face to face. Jairus, in other words, is a person of status and privilege. But in typical Markan irony, he does not hold an advantage regarding the one thing that matters. It is the woman who exemplifies faith. Well, in both cases, we've seen their faith is a little weak, it's imperfect, and she had sort of a superstitious aspect to hers as well. But despite her embarrassing circumstances, she pushes through both crowd and disciples. She had a greater activity in the sense of her conviction and her faith. Her gender, her namelessness, her uncleanness, her shame, none of these will stop her from reaching Jesus. To this undaunted woman comes the healing and liberating word, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. So she exemplifies the type of faith that Jairus needed to have as well, the faith that needs no limits, not even the limits of raising a dead child. But these three stages of faith, they're important for us in our life, that we have that initiation where we get started, where our hope is invested in Jesus, and we get started on the pathway of faith. And then we need to take action in our faith. We need to have conviction, and we need to really have that conviction that drives us to action, and then we need to work that faith out in a persevering and enduring fashion so that we take that word of assurance from Jesus and we don't give up, but we keep on believing, we keep on persevering in faith. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 1 to 2. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for. You recognize some of the words we've been using. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the men of old gained approval. And then after a litany of witnesses to faith that have been introduced, he finishes up Hebrews 12, verse 1 and 2. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. And let us run with endurance this persevering aspect of faith. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus. He's the author and the perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. As we come to our Lord Jesus in communion this morning, let's have our faith, our eyes of faith, firmly focused upon him. Let's pray.